What extremes will government take can go to suppress information from us? Dr. Matthew Alford joins us next. It's into Hollywood and all other places. We'll talk to him about his new work, National Security Cinema, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Dr. Matthew Alford. He's a teaching fellow at the University of Bath in England. His doctoral thesis applied Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky's propaganda model to the contemporary Hollywood film industry. His first book was called Real Power, Hollywood Cinema and American Supremacy. That was published back in 2010. In 2014, he produced a documentary film of his research, The Writer with No Hands, which premiered at the Hot Docs in Canada and won the runner-up at the MR Popular Film Festival in Iran. In 2017, a new edition of the film was released at an independent venues in 12 countries, his latest book, National Security Cinema. Welcome back, Matthew. It's been a few years. You've been on the show.
Yeah, it has been. Nice to be here. Thanks, George.
You too. How are things in England? I understand they're scared of a new mutant with COVID.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's not very good, is it? Generally speaking.
It doesn't sound that way.
It'll all be all right by the spring, and the world will seem a lot happier, and this will all seem like a distant memory. At the moment, we've got a new strain of coronavirus, which is not more dangerous, but is spreading faster, and it's meant that they've several countries have refused to take flights in from Britain, and there are huge problems at the border between Dover and Calais, which means that there's huge tailbacks of lorries going up several tens of miles. And at the same time as that, we've got the I know you've been hearing about Brexit now for 4 years, but actually on the 31st of December at 11 p.m., Brexit actually comes into force, in the sense that if we don't have a trade deal negotiated by then, Britain will be out of any trading system whatsoever, apart from World Trade Organization terms, which is just a really odd place to be in. So all in all, Britain is in a bit of a weird position. But hopefully, one way or another, come the spring, I think things are going to seem a little bit more cheerful. I don't want to be the voice of doom and gloom on this show.
I hope so, too. It's got to get better, Matthew. Hey, you've done some great documentaries, and your book work has been fantastic. How did you get involved in this angle? How did this all start for you?
I did a doctorate, and, you know, if you do postgraduate study, you have to find some kind of, original angle. And I could see that there has been loads and loads of academic work and journalistic work criticizing the news media, and sort of seeing, you know, who are the power players behind the news media. But really very little had been written about Hollywood, about the entertainment industry. And the stuff that was written about Hollywood was quite kind of, it's kind of rooted in academia and sort of, literary studies, film studies, those kind of things, not very politicized, and no one was really terribly interested in the production processes, like, you know, does the government get involved in making films? And, you know, there was just nothing out there about that. So I decided to take that on as a kind of, instead of looking at news media and sort of overall political discourse, I thought it'd be interesting to hone in on the entertainment side of it. And it was immediately obvious that there was loads going on there that had just been neglected horribly by academia and to a large extent by journalists as well. So I realized that there was a really rich avenue there. And it's been weird, actually. I mean, I've been researching this now for whatever it is, like 15 years, and I'm still really interested.
Long time.
I mean, I do sometimes take a bit of a break away from it to, you know, to sort of recharge and do something a bit different. But it is a really interesting area, this intersection between the entertainment industry and propaganda, really. I don't really like you to use the word propaganda because I think it's loaded with all sorts of different sort of meaning.
You think of Goebbels and the Nazis when you hear propaganda, but
exactly, it's not very useful. And people toss it around quite dangerously, in the same way that with Brexit, for example, people tossed around the word democracy. It's incredibly dangerous because democracy is not just It can seem like it's just, you know, a bunch of people voting for one thing at one time and saying, OK, that's the end of it. But that's how we got into the problem with Britain leaving the EU. Whereas democracy is about lots of other things as well, about accountability and about transparency of government and all those kind of things. In the same way that, you know, propaganda is not just about someone telling a lie. It's about systematic deception over time by powerful institutions for specific ideological ends, etc., etc. So I try to avoid the word a little bit, but sometimes it's useful as a shorthand.
Sometimes you have to. And with propaganda, Matthew, comes really not only the entity that wants to do the propaganda, but you have the entity that will fall for it and use it. And it sounds like that's what Hollywood's been doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, Hollywood is susceptible to state influence. And a lot of that is to do with the fact that they want to save a bit of money and they want to have good relationships with the government. And so, you know, why not? What harm does it do them to cooperate with the government? Particularly as there's not much of a fuss made about it, because no one really knows much about it. It's just a sort of industry inside, set of relationships where producers allow the government to come in, take a look at scripts and change scripts in exchange for providing helicopters and aircraft carriers and advice and
submarines and everything else. Interesting. Explain to us, Matthew, how technically it would work. Who approaches who first, and how does this mechanism begin?
Well, in theory, what should happen is that a film producer should go along to the Pentagon and sometimes the CIA and say, we want some help on this. Please, can you assist us to make this film more accurate on this script? We want to make sure that the language is correct, for example, that we use military language properly. And then the Pentagon should come in, advise on that, and then provide huge bits of kit that the filmmakers request. And they should provide that for the filmmakers should still pay for that, albeit at a reduced cost. But actually what happens in practice is, well, one of the things is that actually sometimes those costs are rather fiddled in a way that I hesitate to call corruption, but in a way that is not necessarily accepted all around by everyone writing about it. but the main thing is that the depth and breadth of the script changes that are required by the Pentagon are so much greater than anyone actually knows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really serious problem because it means that they're changing history, changing representation of American foreign policy, American power all the time. So, for example, they have showstoppers, which means basically, you know, things that they just simply will not allow to be in a film if they're going to be working on it. And they're things like, you know, you're not allowed to show that that you've lost a nuclear weapon. You're not allowed to show racism in the military, for example. You're not allowed to show the military's inability to deal with issues of sexual assault, anything to do with torture, coups, illegal arms sales, assassinations, weapons of mass destruction, war crimes, anything like that. It all has to go. And they've tied the producers into contracts on every individual film and TV show that on which this relates. So, you know, they're able to exercise a considerable degree of authority. A little bit like you could perhaps see them as the institution, the political institution, as as another producer, a sort of hidden executive producer, which is also happens to be extremely active in terms of shaping.
Would there be a division within the Pentagon somewhere that has a staff that does just this?
Yeah, that's exactly it. There is the Entertainment Liaison Office in the Department of Defense, which is in charge of this and has been doing this for many, many decades, but just very much under the radar, and has received occasionally little pieces of criticism, but very limited, just in the sort of in the newspapers, it kind of pops up sort of very infrequently. And yeah, they have a staff, and they supposedly wait for these film producers to come to them. But again, there's a lot of that sort of narrative, that kind of benign narrative of what the Pentagon does, is not really the case. Because actually, as we've found from a lot of new documentation over the past 5 years or so, oftentimes they're going out to Comic-Con and lots of other conferences, and they're arranging meetings, and they're being actually very proactive in the industry to foster relationships. And that's particularly the case with the CIA as well, which is a sort of junior player in this. The Pentagon does much more. But the CIA is very much able to get in very early on film scripts so that it can persuade. Rather than providing a great deal of materiel, it gets in very early to... funnily enough, actually, just last night, I was on British TV. There's only a few channels on British TV, unless you've got a decent telly, which I don't. But I was just, you know, literally just flicking over. There was Kingsman on a one channel, and then the next channel I turned over to, it was Mission Impossible, the first one. You know, these are both CIA... Kingsman is an MI5 assisted project, and Mission Impossible was, right from the outset in the Tom Cruise films, was a CIA assisted project.
There was a movie. Go ahead, Matt.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's not always clear the extent to which there is script interference, particularly from the CIA, because they're much more careful with their, well, not careful, maybe that's the wrong word, but they're more secretive really with their paperwork, and they like to do things informally by telephone, for example. But you know, it's pretty clear from dribs and drabs that have come out, for example, through leaked documentation through a court case about the Al Pacino film The Recruit, that the CIA does sometimes exercise considerable influence, literally sort of write rough drafts of scripts in certain cases.
There was a movie in 1995 called Crimson Tide that starred Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington.
Yes.
And they were upon a Navy submarine. Hackman was the commanding officer. Denzel was the executive officer. And there was the whole movie revolved around questioning Gene Hackman's ability because they lost a message on whether to launch or not against the Soviets at the time. But I would guess, because there was a submarine involved and they did a lot of filming inside of a sub, they had to get cooperation from the Navy and the Pentagon, right?
Well, that's mostly right. I can't remember exactly the extent to which they had influence over Crimson Tide. I think there was actually a problem, as I recall, with giving full cooperation. So what the Pentagon has is a series of different levels of cooperation that they provide. Full cooperation basically means that you're looking at a really heavily... basically an advert for the military in one way or another. And they are very common. So films like Pearl Harbor, which was on the night before on my television, is, full cooperation. Crimson Tide, I think, may have only been courtesy cooperation or limited cooperation. And that's because of exactly the thing that you picked up on, which is that there's this mutiny on a ship, and they don't like showing.
They don't like that stuff.
That said, they exercise caution about that and sort of their own judgment. So films like A Few Good Men, they provided limited cooperation, but I think that if they were to do that again, if a similar script came in today, I think they would, from what I can tell, from what they've mentioned in interviews and things, that they would probably go for a script like that now, because it shows that the system does actually work. So Jack Nicholson's character at the end is actually brought to justice. So they would have been probably a bit keener on that now. Same thing with something like Courage Under Fire, which was the Meg Ryan movie, where they provided limited cooperation for a film set in Iraq. Again, about kind of mutiny and problems in the ranks. But generally speaking, they still are able to some extent to shape those scripts, because even if they don't provide full cooperation, even if the relationship isn't 100% tight, they're still able to exercise influence and advice over early stages of the drafting process. So, if a good example would be something like Independence Day, which we've actually only found this out in the past few months, because we've been making a film, a documentary film to go along with this. And as part of that, Roger Stahl from the US, a professor over there, has done a huge research project of his own, sort of building on what myself and Tom Secker did. And one of the things he found was that in the case of Independence Day, which that ultimately negotiations fell through, partly because they wanted to represent aliens in Roswell and all this kind of thing. But one of the things Roger found out from documentation unearthed recently is that they, you know, in the scenes where they blow up the White House and blow up NORAD and all that. Yes, well, there was another scene that they wanted to film there, which was to blow up the Pentagon. But they, even though there was ultimately no contract signed between the Pentagon
and the movie people,
filmmakers, they were still able to get that to be removed, as well as many other changes.
I've always wondered if stories of UFOs, movies of UFOs, are leaked Pentagon information that we knew about as a government to producers like Steven Spielberg and people like that, and simply said, look, we're being visited, go ahead and do Close Encounters of the Third Kind or something like that. Is that possible?
Well, yeah, that's something that myself and another colleague, Robbie Graham, looked into. I don't know if you...
He's a UFO... He's a UFO researcher, isn't he?
Yeah, and he wrote a book. He sort of wrote the book on the relationship between cinema and UFOs, which is called Silver Screen Sources, which I very much recommend. And he and I wrote one of the very few peer-reviewed academic articles about... the relationship between the media and UFOs. This was a few years ago now, but we're meant to be doing a thing. COVID interferes with so many things, but that was one of the... we're meant to be doing something a couple of days ago for the Anomalist website, where Robbie and I were going to work together again and talk about this, but I think it will be delayed for a couple of weeks. But, yes, there are cases where... the government has seeded information into films or into documentaries. One of the interesting things about Close Encounters, actually, was that it was kind of the opposite of that. I think, at least from the documentation that we have, which is obviously limited, it seems that NASA actually wanted to prevent that film from coming out. There was Spielberg himself in this obscure interview from 1977, which I had to file about 50 different library request to actually find the original quote to check that it was legitimate. But he said that he received a 20-page letter from NASA in the run-up to the release of Close Encounters saying, we don't want this to be released because we're worried that after what happened with everyone panicking about sharks following the release of Jaws a couple of years prior, we don't want the same thing happening again and having these enormous number of reports coming in from people seeing things in the skies.
And look what's happening now with the Pentagon releasing some videos of UFOs being chased by fighter pilots.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a reason they're doing that.
I think it's really, really interesting. And, yeah, of course there's a reason for it. I feel that that's something that I, whenever things like that happen, I go to Robbie Graham. and hopefully when we do the... our own podcast together on the Anomalist in a week or two, then he'll talk further about that. But, yeah, I completely agree with you. It's absolutely fascinating.
Matthew, we're going to take a quick break in a moment and come back and talk about some of your new documentaries, Theaters of Command, and all of this. How widespread is this with other countries? I mean, are the Russians doing what we do with their media, or are they a little more in control?
Yeah, it does happen in all these different countries. The United States is obviously different because Hollywood is so big. And because the military is so big, so there's always going to be a much stronger and greater relationship. But one of the we've just got a new version of a French translation of the book National Security Cinema. Publishers just about to release that, and was meant to be a couple of days ago, probably in a couple of weeks. And so I did a new introduction for that, looking at this particular thing about other countries. It's a question that I get a lot.
Okay, hold on, Matthew. Let's finish that up when we come back. We've got a break we're going to hit, but we'll talk about that and much more. And then we'll take calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Matthew Alford with us as we're talking about his work. We'll get into his documentaries in just a moment. But these other countries, Matthew, I would guess nobody's more involved than the United States, but what are they doing?
Yeah, that's great. No one's really more involved than the United States. But so I looked at a couple of countries, one China, which has the publicity department of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China.
Oh, boy.
They are in charge of cultural output. So they've made films like one that had some international presence called Wolf Warrior in 2015. But generally speaking, yeah, their industry is that much smaller. And then Britain was quite an interesting case as well, where there's no... But with Britain, we don't have like the equivalent of the Pentagon. You know, we do have the Ministry of Defense, but they don't directly get involved in any filmmaking or entertainment production. But they farm it out to private companies. And so our one is called Landmark Solutions and Military Film Services. And they assist on all sorts of things like various soap operas in our country that you may well not know. Things like Sherlock, which you may know.
Mm-hmm.
And also some films like Kick-Ass and The Man from U.N.C.L.E., World War Z, X-Men, and various James Bond films as well. So there are all sorts of informal or sort of less formal routes for other countries' governments to control their own film industries.
With the Nazis, when they were doing their propaganda with Goebbels, of course, they took it way too far because, you know, they started to promote anti-Semitism and tried to get the public behind them with that, which was one of the root causes of their propaganda. But they understood how to manipulate the mind with propaganda, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things, I haven't systematically analyzed Nazi cinematic output, but from what I can tell of looking at the literature and some of the films, is that the Nazis, in their entertainment, they didn't do that much that was overtly kind of hostile, you know, kind of rabble-rousing. There were obviously sort of disgusting images of racial minorities in those films, but a lot of it was actually very sort of saccharine. And very kind of sort of positive, cheesy things about, you know, kind of just sort of banal, sort of soap opera style stories, people going off to the front, kind of popular images of positive things happening in Germany, not necessarily mm-hmm. sort of outright obvious propaganda. And in fact, there's a famous quote from Goebbels where he said, "Don't come to me with propaganda films. Don't come to me with propaganda films. We need to, the only way to the best way to propagandize the population is through entertainment." So that kind of mentality, I think, has been well understood by kind of cultural leaders for, you know, a good century.
As brilliant as they were, why were they so insane? I mean, they committed suicide. Goebbels and his wife killed themselves and their six children after Hitler killed himself. I mean, what's wrong with these people?
I think it's hard to know with someone like Joseph Goebbels. By that point, I don't know if the insane thing that he'd done was murder his own kids. I think he was already pretty insane well before that.
Yeah, that's true too.
Taking it too far. I think if he'd I don't know, what do you think would have happened if he'd let his children live? I suspect that they would have been bayoneted by the Russians. I'm not sure if he made the right call there or not. But I don't know why they were so insane. But a lot of them were really severely ill, weren't they? And they were the kind of rejects of society who were dredged up and fired into positions of high authority. And they had a lot of sort of crazy ideas on things like the occult and destiny. And, I think it's pretty well known. There's a pretty sick cocktail of things going on in the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. But it tells you how far propaganda can take someone.
Yeah, I mean, someone like Hitler was extremely good at, rabble-rousing and providing, you know, and again, going back to that thing of providing a very positive view of a nation, not necessarily spending a great deal of time denouncing specific individuals or specific groups, But generally speaking, trying to promote the idea of a great destiny, a great positive spirit for the nation and for himself, creating this kind of grand narrative of superiority. And of course, that's, you know, that's always going to be more dangerous and more appealing to people, because people like to have positive stories. And I think that's probably why you had a lot of the German people dragged along by that. You know, it seemed like a popular and fun, not so much of a negative thing not so much of a negative message.
Did their propaganda machine come up with the use of the swastika, which was a much older logo that they took and, of course, defamed once they used it? But, I mean, they understood, put logos in certain spots and things like that, didn't they?
I think that was all, that sort of relates to the occult, doesn't it? I think that was a Hindu symbol that they adopted in about 1923, right at the very beginning of the Nazi Party.
Which was very benign until the Nazis got it.
Yeah, I think it was just a symbol of peace, and then they just inverted it. I think because by inverting it, they were saying, you know, a symbol of war now, or a kind of perversion of what it was originally meant to be anyway. Of course, they were very good at, you know, getting away from, not just in terms of films, but, I mean, simply the swastika and the Nazi flag and the use of those kind of very bold colors, red, black, and white, which are, you know, extremely striking colors, and the way that they designed and orchestrated their, almost like a sort of set design. Those famous films, Olympia and Triumph of the Will, where Hitler, for example, is shown flying over America, and is, you know, one of these early pioneering uses of cameras in airplanes. And then Riefenstahl has him, the shadow of Hitler's plane going over Germany, as though he is kind of this overlord who is overseeing and understands all of the terrain beneath him. That was pretty early on. That was 1933, I think,
when the Nazis took over, I think, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Matthew Alford with us. We're going to take calls with him next hour here on Coast to Coast. You have a documentary you co-produced called Theaters of Command. Tell us about that.
So the new documentary, Theaters of Command, is based on mine and Tom's book, which is National Security Cinema from 2017. But basically that book, which had no advertising or anything. We just put it out as quickly as we could because we received all this documentation and we felt that it was important to do so. And then some people became interested in it, including a professor called Roger Stahl at Atlanta University in the US. And so Roger's work has been absolutely crazy because he's a very good filmmaker for an organization called MES, Media Education Foundation. And he decided to go off not just to make a film about our research, but to build on it as well. I think he felt a little bit bad, actually, that me and Tom, a couple of kind of sort of part-time journalists from Britain, had found all this material. And so he was kind of motivated to do a massive two-year research project himself while making the film. So he went to go and meet military veterans. He's driven all around the United States, flown around the United States, acquired a hell of a lot of new material. It's basically his journey into this huge world of government duplicity. I've seen the rough cut of the film in the last week or two, and it should be out in the new year. But it'll be fantastic.
And versions of National Security Cinema really have just come out as well, right? In different parts of the world.
Yeah, National Security Cinema is just about to be, or I think it's just been translated, and they're just finishing up the cover into French. Now, obviously, many of your listeners won't speak French, but we did various new bits for the French edition. So, for example, the new preface is out on is just out for free now. If you want to read that, on spyculture.com, which is Tom Secker's website, which is the repository of all of the files that we've received over the past 5 or 6 years.
Well, now, what drives you the most when it comes to all of this, Matthew? What fascinates you?
That's a really good question, and I think it's I think that there's nothing more interesting in a way than people love entertainment, and I think entertainment is kind of the thing that makes people happiest, really, and it's the most fun thing. So I find it kind of this weird incongruity, this weird and horrible clash that entertainment, which should be this thing of beauty, smashes together so horribly with political manipulation, and particularly militaristic manipulation, which is encouraging the Western world, particularly the United States, but also my country, providing the mood music for war, and very serious wars as well, not minor things, huge clashes. And with that kind of nationalist ferment going on within these products that we should just be relaxing with and enjoying and trusting, I think that's a very dangerous and heady, but also a very interesting mix.
I think so, too. Now, also, you know, you were mentioning UFO researcher Robbie Graham, and just how much into the UFO area have you gone?
I, like I said, I wrote a sort of, whatever it was, 5,000 or 6,000 word paper with Robbie about this back in 2012, I think it was. People are welcome to look that up on 49th Parallel was the name of the journal. And it was about how the military had intervened in trying to prevent various documentaries coming out. And then at other points where small military groups from within the Pentagon had supported other documentaries. I don't know if you know that, but the Robert Emmenegger documentary, for example. And so we interviewed Emmenegger and Robbie looked at some of the more recent cases as well, including the Disney film Race to Witch Mountain, where there was this kind of... Because sometimes, usually what we've found is that, these filmmakers go through the entertainment liaison offices, the formal channels, but sometimes they don't go through formal channels. And there are weird organizations that turn up that seem to be government and military, and then they exert some kind of influence over the script. So on the case of Race to Witch Mountain by Disney in 2015, there was a military person that took them around NORAD, but was unidentified and was not tied specifically to any particularly PR apparatus. Another good case would be the TV series Dark Skies, for example, in the 90s, where Bryce Abel, the producer of that...
Right, Bryce has been on the show a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I won't speak too much for him then, but he does talk about there being attempts to contact him by the shadowy military figures and to have some kind of influence over the script and showing him weird hieroglyphs and things like that. Now, that's something that is outside of the usual channels, the usual PR channels, and that happens with other things. Occasionally it happens even with something like one of the Bond films, for example, was given unofficial cooperation. They just didn't list it. So it does sometimes happen that that occurs, and it's even more kind of mysterious and a little bit chilling when that kind of thing happens, because they're really going outside of the usual processes.
I was going to ask you about the James Bond films and whether the United Kingdom, the government of the UK, looked at those films or participated in them a lot, and I would think they would.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, although saying that, until we began this research, as with a lot of these things, the assumption was that, this was just a flippant piece of frippery, really, that was not tied into government interests and would not be influenced by those forces. But actually, yeah, you're damn right that they do exert influence over the Bond films. They do have advisors on set. That said, we don't, as with the British cases, as with Russian cases and as with Chinese cases, etc., it's much harder to determine script changes. It's really, really hard to determine script changes that are made by the government in the United States as well. But because of the Freedom of Information Act and because there are so many examples, 100 times more than any other country, we're able to get a reasonably good picture. But we're not quite sure with the Bond films the exact nature of the changes. They also helped on a series called Spooks, which I think was called something different. Spooks, which was called something different, I think, in your country when it came out. And of course, the original books of the James Bond films, Ian Fleming sent every single one of those manuscripts to someone at MI5 to be checked. In the same way that John Le Carre, the Tinker Tailor Soldier spy who died 2 or 3 days ago, you know, he was all part of the, you know, part of the same kind of group of people, really. Load of old spies. Roald Dahl was the same, you know.
How serious do governments take propaganda today?
Well, I mean, I think it's what it's all about, really.
It's gotten bigger?
Say again, sorry.
It's gotten bigger, you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, governments have always lied. And, you know, the second oldest profession is spying. So that's kind of a given. But because of the increasing complexity of the way that discourse is put out, namely the internet, and also because a lot of governments have less legitimacy now than, say, 40 or 50 years ago, because people's living standards have declined, usually in real terms, and we've got the rise of quite a few weird and dodgy demagogues all over the planet. So governments have to be much more dependent on propaganda, on messaging. I mean, it's a good case with the CIA, for example. I mean, there were just the beginnings of movements after the end of communism, because our side didn't have a big enemy anymore. There were sort of whisperings around, and senators.
Hold on for a second, Matthew. We're at the top of the hour. Let's come back and talk about the rest of that CIA story, what your thoughts are about fake news, whether it's propaganda, and we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.